In tonight's session is entitled Age of Peace and Affluence. And he'll take some time to explain what that means. Now, one of the things that you've seen is, as he's kind of developed this from the, say, the demise of the Roman Empire on, in as Western thought developed in Western civilization, you see where there was a fairly large movement toward the Scripture as the basis for public thinking. You know, there is a consensus. You know, whether you like to say it is this is or not. You know, if you're in Italy, for example, you're essentially a Roman Catholic country, at least nominally. And so there's kind of a consensus there. When Matt and Charlie and I were in Poland working with a girl named Agnieszka, Agnieszka's dad was very upset over the fact that Agnieszka had been immersed while she was here. And so he and I had a private discussion, and he said, look, in Poland, everyone is either atheist or Catholic. That's it. And he said, so, you know, I do not appreciate my daughter being something other than atheist or Catholic. You know, that's what he said. And, you know, I mean, Agnieszka, she got back and she got sucked back in to the lifestyle, the consensus. See, that's how it is, and that's how important the local congregation is, because without the local congregation, society or the consensus overpowers. But over a period of time, you see where there's a strong movement away from the Bible as being the basis of public thinking. And the thing that really tipped the scales on that was Charles Darwin's Origin of Species, published in 1859. And with the publication of The Origin of Species, they found the alternative to creation that they were looking for. In, as is pointed out, the doctrine of natural selection seemed to be an explanation as to how you could move from a lower life form and have it organized upward to eventually man, who presumes himself under those conditions to be the most organized life form. Although I've had university students, one time I was showing the origin videos on the university campus and had quite a discussion with a young man publicly who he was maintaining that dolphins are more intelligent and far superior to man. And so that's where you'd expect it to really go when you have an evolutionary base. Now, you got to understand, evolution is not science. It's a belief system. And there was kind of mini editorial in the paper here a couple days ago, the Boston Chronicle, where the guy actually stayed in there, "We believe." You know, some years ago, the Smithsonian Institution put out a tract. And the title of the tract is Why Scientists Believe in Evolution. See, and you got to understand that modern science, in words of the guy that testified in the big case that decided the issue of creation in public schools in Arkansas, Michael Ruse, he said, science operates against a backdrop or presupposition or backdrop of unbroken regularity. And see, a presupposition is we've already set the box. We've already decided what the box includes, and we've already decided what the box excludes. And so what they did on a philosophical basis, they said that science excludes God. And once that happened, see, the scientists then were elevated as being the thinkers, the objective ones. And so then Darwinism began to permeate all aspects of human thought. And now, of course, it was pushed. See, it was driven by forces, like a wind pushes leaves. And those forces then result in what we're going to see tonight with regard to what he calls the age of peace and affluence. Okay? And some of the things connected with that. So, God willing, this will roll.
transhumanistic thought has come down in many, many forms. Until at a certain point of history, now I would put it in the early 1960s, people heard the same message coming at them from absolutely every side. Whether they read the book of philosophy, or they went into the art museum, or they listened to music, or they read a modern novel, or they went to the philosophic cinema, it was always the same. And that is that on a humanistic basis, reason leads to despair, to no answers. And people should try to find answers in the area of non-reason. It had brought people to the place where there were no fixed values whatsoever. These were completely gone. And the great majority of people had come to the place where they had only two horrendous values, absolutely horrible values: personal peace and affluence. Now, because I'm going to use these terms over and over again in this episode, let me define them carefully, and I'd urge you, please listen with care. As I use the term personal peace, I mean I want to be left alone. And I don't care what happens to the man across the street or across the world. I want my own lifestyle to be undisturbed, regardless of what it will mean even to my own children and grandchildren. Now that's what I mean by personal peace. Affluence means things, 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 always more things, and success seen as an abundance of things.
In the early 60s, a whole generation had been injected by the teaching that reason leads only to pessimism in the area of a meaning of life and of any values.
Students have been hearing this from the professors for a long, long time.
Understood, interpreted. One, therefore, is supposed.
As a matter of fact, there was a generation that had never been taught anything else. But there was an inconsistency here, because most of these professors who taught that life had no meaning and there were no fixed values, they didn't live that way. They were living in the memory of the past. But we should not have been surprised that at a certain point of time, one generation would act, really act, upon what they had been taught. These students looked around them. They saw these two horrible values of personal peace and affluency being on every side, and they revolted. And that revolution was Berkeley, 1964. Looking back into that which is now past history, we don't understand where we are today unless we take a moment to understand the flow through Berkeley of 1964. They really wanted to escape the two values of personal peace and affluence. And they did it in two different ways. First of all came the drug scene, the hippie scene. And we've already seen in a previous episode that Aldous Huxley said that as reason does not, humanistic reason doesn't give a meaning to life, and we can't find objective truth, give drugs to well people in order that they might try to find truth inside of their own head. The hippie world followed this, and they followed it very explicitly. It was an ideology to them. Let's not make any mistake. Back in those days, it was really an ideology. They really believed in it. They really believed that if you could just take and put drugs into the drinking water, LSD, into the drinking water of the reservoirs of the cities of the world, you had enough people turned on that civilization's problems would be solved. They believed it with all their heart.
Getting high with the help of your friends. It's a very powerful message.
About the same time at Berkeley, there arose a second element in this attempt to escape these two terrible values of personal peace and affluency. This was the free speech movement. At first, the free speech movement on Sproul Plaza was neither left nor right. It was simply a desire, a demand that they have a right to have freedom, to have political rallies on Sproul Plaza.
And by God, people, we have to push Reagan right back to the wall, and if we have to, we got to push him right through the wall. And we got to tell him, no, baby, this is our university.
But quickly, it slipped into the new left following Marcuse. Marcuse was a German philosopher, a Marxist, and at that time he was teaching at San Diego. This spread over the whole world. We can think, for example, of the Paris riots in 1968. Here they are seeking freedom from these two values. They had the right analysis. Let me say that as somebody who was older. They had the right analysis. This was where our society was, with just two terrible values of personal peace and affluency. But the tragedy was they tried the wrong solutions. The drug culture came to its height. Woodstock at the festival there in 1969. But in Altima, in 1969, there was another festival, and the Hell's Angels, who were hired to police the ground, killed at least one man. And the Rolling Stone, the magazine, came out and quoted someone after that as saying, "We've lost our age of innocency." And the drug culture was finished. It was completely finished after the Isle of Wight Festival in 1970, which ended so ugly, in such an ugly fashion in Europe. After that, drug taking changed. Mind you, not less people taking drugs unhappily, but no longer taking them as an ideology. The unhappy thing is probably more people are taking drugs and taking them at a younger age. But drug taking as an ideology was absolutely done. The new left went the same way, gradually ground down. It brought forth, naturally, violence. Violence in the United States, violence in Europe. And the idealistic young people really didn't like the violence that it just reasonably and naturally brought forth. In 1970, the radical students bombed the University of Wisconsin lab building, killing a graduate student. Bombs continue to be planted in the United States, and a small, hardcore of radicals continues to exist. But the violence of the new left, climaxing in the bombing of this laboratory building, made most young people in the United States no longer see the new left as a hope. So here the students were, and they had tried to escape these two awful values of personal peace and fluency, and now their two hopes, the new left and the drug thing, was gone. What were they left with? And they were left with apathy. Apathy. Many, many people were so glad when the universities quieted down at that time. And in one way, it's good it did quiet down. But I could have wept, and I did weep as I met these young people after this. All they had left was apathy. They had tried to escape their parents' poor values, or society's poor values, and they'd gone around in a circle and come back and ended one inch lower. And now apathy ruled with them, and what was left? The two values of personal peace and affluency now ruled supreme. Now, turning away from the United States, a dominant, strong minority in Europe, and a majority of students, for example, let's say in South America and other parts of the world, they turn to a new leap into the area of non-reason. And that is, they committed themselves to the Marxist, Leninist, or the Maoist line. Why is this a new kind of leap into the area of non-reason, as utopian in a bad sense as the old drug leap? Well, I'll tell you why. It's simply because everywhere where Marxian Leninism has come to power, it has always meant oppression. Always. And these young people just close their eyes to that. They close their eyes to the fact that oppression is a part of the communistic system.
бережность, и я бы сказал, та нежность.
No one has pointed this out more to us than Saul Solzhenitsyn in his emphasis as he's brought it into the Western world in his writings and lectures. And he has said that 15 million inmates of the prison camps existed at one time in Soviet Russia. He has said that from the communist revolution in Russia until only 1959, 66 million people died for political reasons. So everywhere one looks in the communist world, it always brings forth internal oppression. But we must never forget, it also brings forth external oppression. We could think of various things, but the thing which quickly comes to our mind is Hungary and Czechoslovakia. I was living in Switzerland in November 4, 1956, when the Russian tanks moved into Hungary. And at that particular time, I had a radio with a shortwave band. All day long, I listened to the Hungarian students speaking in English, sometimes broken English, sometimes good English, hoping the external world would listen. I was marked by that day. I'll never forget it. Never. Those voices pleading for help. The newspapers, right after that, carried a picture of a beautiful, open-faced, lovely girl called Ilon Troth. The picture was a picture of Ilon Troth on trial for her life because of her part in trying to stand against the external oppression that Marxist-Leninism naturally brings with it. She was hanged on July 1957. Marxist-Leninism is a leap. It's a leap for another reason, or even a more basic one than the one I've given. Its foundation, its philosophy, is materialism. Now, all through this series, we've shown that humanism, man beginning from himself, cannot generate any real values or meaning or any real dignity to man. And here is a system that is built completely and consciously and totally on materialism. There is no place for the dignity of man in a materialistic system. So-called communism with a human face that some of the thinkers in communist-controlled countries have pled for, and some outside of communist-controlled countries have also pled for, it isn't possible. It just isn't possible on the basis of materialism. And yet, strangely enough, the young people and older ones in non-communist countries are caught by the idealistic Marxian-Leninism.
And it was my conviction after examining the different trends in parties and so forth that the Communist Party most held to those ideals. And was
the reason is that there's so much talk of dignity. Dignity of man, be treated better.
In order to solve those problems and in order to give life a meaningful and purposeful life to young people.
Where does this come from on a materialistic base? It doesn't. Do you want to know what it is? I'll tell you. And there's only one way to understand idealistic utopian Marxianism, and that is that it's a Christian heresy.
And in struggling against and condemning that which is wrong in the world, and Lord knows there's enough of what's wrong in the world,
idealistic utopian communism simply reaches over, takes these words, which could never be produced out of materialistic philosophy, brings them back, uses them, separated from the natural results of their own position, and in doing so, catches these who are caught by idealistic Marxian-Leninism. But when Marxian-Leninism comes to power, it's a different story. It's always oppression, and the will of the majority suddenly has no meaning. Not only does the dignity of the individual cease to exist, but the will of the majority has no meaning either. Now we must understand there are two streams of Leninism, Marxianism. They must be kept separate, and we must see these two streams clearly. The first is the idealistic utopian stream. These usually young people, though sometimes older, who have leapt into the area of non-reason, to accept Marxian-Leninism. That's one stream. The second stream is the hardcore Orthodox Communist Party members in various countries outside of the Communist bloc. Now, we find that the danger is that people who have only the two values of personal peace and affluency, if they seem to be promised peace and affluency by communism, nobody knows what great majorities of these people will do. Nobody knows. More than that, we must see there's a danger in that these two streams of the idealistic Marxian-Leninism and the hardcore Marxian-Leninism orthodox party could flow together in a country at a given moment of history and create a situation that would be forever irreversible. And that is a very real danger.
Подобного рода опасность стоит и перед Соединенными Штатами в целом.
This type of danger is before the United States just as well.
The United States has also its marks very much upon it, and no more so in any area than the area of the generation of arbitrary law. I want to talk about arbitrary law at some length, actually. Man demanded to be autonomous from God and God's revelation. And what this has resulted in is relativity, not only in personal and public morals, but in law as law. The nature which men try to build their law on, as we remember back in one of the previous episodes, just is not sufficient for the simple reason that nature is both cruel and non-cruel, and as such you cannot build a stable system of law on nature. And what we're left in the humanist flow today in the United States is purely variable sociological law. Now, by sociological, what I mean is law that is merely based on what some group decides is good for society at a given moment. The man who opened the door for this, perhaps more than anyone else, was Oliver Wendell Holmes. And he wrote in a letter, I'll quote him exactly, "The ultimate question is, what do the dominant forces of the community want? And do they want it hard enough to disregard whatever inhibitions stand in the way?" And this was Oliver Wendell Holmes quite a few years ago. And really what it amounts to is purely variable law. Much modern law is not consistent with a law that has preceded it. And as a matter of fact, we must say that the Constitution of the United States today can be made to say almost anything on the basis of sociological variable law. Now, we must understand that a law today is not just variable law, but that the courts are actually making law. They're not only interpreting the law that the legislative has made, but they actually generate law. Now, everybody knows, who knows anything at all about these things, that arbitrary law dominates completely in communistic countries. But what most people don't realize is that on the humanist flow, arbitrary law has swept over into the Western world as well. I'd like to use an illustration.
Consider the human fetus, the unborn baby. In January 1973, the United States Supreme Court passed the abortion law. Professor Witherspoon of the University of Texas School of Law writes, "The court held that the unborn child is not a person within the meaning of the 14th Amendment, so as to strip all unborn children of all constitutional protection for their lives, liberty, and property." This ruling by the United States Supreme Court is a totally arbitrary absolute. First of all, it is arbitrary medically. This book was put out with the cooperation of many noted scientists in this field, including some from the United States. It was to inform the British public. It favors abortion. However, it says that the question as to when human life begins is an open question. It, abortion, can be carried out before the fetus becomes viable, although when that is in itself an arguable point. It further states that a biologist might say that human life started at the moment of fertilization when the sperm and the ovum merged. The arbitrariness medically of the Supreme Court decision is underlined by the fact that the destruction of the fetus is accepted in abortion. And yet questions are raised as to whether it is right to fertilize an ovum outside of the womb, that is in the laboratory, because then it would only live for a few days. This points up the problem that if such a fertilized ovum were successfully implanted in the womb, that it would have the full genetic potential for becoming a human being. What does this make the 5.5-month-old aborted baby to be? Because it too has the full genetic potential for becoming a human being. Justice White of the Supreme Court, in his dissent concerning the abortion law, said that it is an exercise of raw judicial power, an improvident and extravagant exercise of the power of judicial review. Upon this arbitrary ruling, medically and legally, the abortion laws of almost every state in the Union were set aside. Most people accepted this law, even though it was arbitrary medically and legally, because it was considered sociologically helpful. Why would they not accept laws curtailing human freedom if these were considered sociologically helpful? What we're left with is sociological law, and that is all. And nobody knows where it will end. By this Supreme Court ruling, the unborn child is considered not to be a person. In our own day, there's been a great outcry, and quite properly, that in the past, the black slave was viewed as a non-person. But now, by this arbitrary absolute brought in the humanist flow, millions of unborn children of every color of skin are declared by law to be non-persons.
Now, a question has to be asked. In the day when there are no fixed values, why could not the aged, the incurably ill, the insane, and other classes of persons equally arbitrarily be declared to be non-person on the basis of arbitrary law if the courts thought that it was sociologically helpful? In a day like our own, what's unthinkable today might not prove, and probably will not prove, unthinkable in a very, very few years. Now, let's move on a bit. As the Christian consensus dies, as the basis of our culture, society does not really have many bases upon which it has the possibility of building. One is that everybody would simply do their own thing. And this has the technical name of hedonism. It means everybody would do what they want to do. But the simple fact is that it is not possible to build a society on everybody doing what they want to do. One could think of a single man living on a desert island. He can do anything he wants to do within the form of the universe. But when two men are on that desert island and they have to have interrelationship, it is no longer possible for every man to do what he wants to do. I often think of the illustration of two men trying to do their own thing, regardless of what anybody else thinks, meeting on a narrow bridge. And as they meet on the narrow bridge, something has to happen. They both can't do their own thing. Everybody understands you can't build a society on people doing what they want to do, on hedonism. All right, then, hedonism is a theoretical basis for society after the Christian consensus is gone. But if it's not possible, what other possibilities are there? Well, there's the possibility of the total dominance of the 51% vote. Now, remember, it was Christianity, the Reformation, Christianity in the north of Europe, that brought forth the forms and the freedoms which we have under the 51% vote. But I'm talking about 51% vote after there is no absolute by which to judge the 51% vote. There was a time in the days when the Christian culture was more dominant, when the lone individual could stand up with the Bible in his hand and say, "You're wrong. even though the majority has voted the other way. But as the Christian consensus is gone, then there is no absolute by which to judge the 51%. And then this is a very, very different situation. I'll give you a sentence that I wish you'd memorize. If there is no absolute by which to judge society, society is absolute. The heart of the humanist thinking is making the individual man and then mankind the center of all things, his own measure, of making him autonomous. If we're going to live and escape death, not only death individually in the sense of the judgment of God, but death in our culture, in our political life, in our present life, we must turn from that humanist way of making man autonomous, and we must put the Creator at the center of all things. The greatest of all wickedness is putting any created thing in the place of the Creator. And when we turn from this, our feet are turned from the paths of death to the paths of life.
Turn your Bibles to 1 Timothy chapter 1. Writing to Timothy, a young evangelist, the Apostle Paul lays out, first of all, what the goal of our instruction is. And then he goes on to talk about the nature of man and what the purpose of the gospel, or how the gospel itself interacts with man as a whole. 1 Timothy chapter 1, beginning in verse 3, says, "As I urged you upon my departure from Macedonia, to remain on in Ephesus in order that you may instruct certain men not to teach strange doctrines, or pay attention to the myths and endless genealogies which give rise to mere speculation rather than furthering the administration of God, which is by faith. See, but the goal of our instruction is love from a pure heart and a good conscience and a sincere faith. For some men, straying from these things, have turned aside to fruitless discussion, wanting to be teachers of the law, even though they do not understand either what they're saying or matters about which they make confident assertions. But we know the law is good if one uses it lawfully, realizing the fact that law is not made for a righteous man, but for those who are lawless and rebellious, for the ungodly and sinners, for the unholy and profane, for those who kill their fathers or mothers, for murderers and immoral men and homosexuals and kidnappers and liars and perjurers, and whatever else is contrary to sound teaching, according to the gospel of glory of the blessed God with which I've been entrusted." Now, the nature of man, of course, is brought out here. And man has been fighting against God. Man naturally wants to do his own thing. And the illustration of Francis Schaeffer walking on the narrow bridge is a good example of that. The problem is when two people each want to do their own thing, it's going to come in conflict. And so society has to be built on some sort of order. And so the idea is that man, ultimately cannot be lawless and have a society built. Now, the culture of hedonism, or the culture of humanism, has been carefully crafted and carefully injected into Western society over the generations. See, one of the reasons, if you go back and think about the Renaissance, where it talked about the humanists there that were building those bell towers and stuff in Florence. See, they were laying the foundation for what was to come. Behind it, of course, every step of the way have been the banking interest, whether it was the Medicis of ancient Italy, whether it was the Knights Templars, a little bit later, whether it was the Rothschilds or the Rockefellers or who knows how many today, but have been carefully and consciously herding mankind into the direction of humanism. Now, one of the things he opened with, you know, you kind of saw the vinyl platter spinning. Isn't it amazing that since 1984 that vinyl platters have been replaced by 8-tracks, which were replaced by cassettes, which were replaced by CDs. We have, accelerated things. But he made the point that the humanist agenda is coming at you from every direction. Every direction. How could it be coming at you from every direction? See, if there were not a bigger hand behind it. Ultimately, of course, we recognize that Satan himself is the only one with the intelligence, the capacity, and the longevity to be able to coordinate that sort of thing. Now, one of the pictures you saw was Oliver Wendell Holmes. He was the guy with the mustache, and he basically made the statement that that law is going to be whatever society wants it to be if society has a sufficient drive to get there. Now, man is Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes on the U.S. Supreme Court is who that is. Okay. The lady is spoken first at Berkeley and then a little bit later, Bettina Affleker, is a longtime communist. She was a lesbian, is a lesbian. She currently is a professor at University of California, Santa Cruz, where, nothing surprises you. But she was part of the New Left. The Woodstock and the things that followed Woodstock really were part of an ideological thing. When I was in high school, there were no drugs in the high schools in the state of Montana. Drugs did not exist. I've talked to other people who were at larger schools, like in Great Falls or Billings or Missoula, and drugs were non-existent there, too, as well, until 1967. See, in 1967, the drug culture was unleashed. Now, driving that was guys like Timothy Leary. And of course, he was being promoted by other interests. I mean, a nutcase that's zoned out all the time is not going to get publicity unless somebody wants to give him publicity, all right? And so he was promoted. The drug culture was promoted. At the same time, the powers that be pretended not to be supporting the drug culture. But it really was an ideology. I had a roommate in Las Vegas. His name was David Izett. David was from Lafayette, California, and he was a student at a private college in Lafayette. Lafayette's in the East Bay area. But he was on that ideological base. I mean, he really believed, in all honesty, that the taking of drugs would cure society's ills, that if people would just, have a little LSD experience and have some of the bright lights play and have that good feeling, then society would actually turn around. But as they pointed out, you had Woodstock, you had Altima, and then you had the Isle of Wight. They had their big Isle of Wight's an island just off the south coast of England. And it turned out really ugly in 1970, and that was the last one they had until recent years where they reopened it again. But see, as he pointed out, the idea that drugs now as an ideology that to solve mankind's problem proved wrong, because every place that went, the violence turned out. I was in San Francisco in 1967. 1967 was a year you put a flower in your hair and you went to San Francisco, and there's a lot of peace-loving brethren there. The idea. A lot of gentle people there was, I think, the exact words of the song. And, it was about that time Golden Gate Park became really unsafe. See, what supposedly was, be the beautiful people ended up a place where, I guarantee you no bathhouse was any place you wanted to be near. Now, see, something happened. He also pointed out the other thing was to turn in the direction of the new left. See, the left has always had this tremendous appeal, you know, the brotherhood of man and uplifting the downtrodden and the cause that you could dedicate yourself to. A man by the name of Benjamin Bigelow wrote an excellent book on the communist revolutionaries entitled The Whole of Their Lives. See, I mean, it is something that will grab the attention of an individual and think he's doing something good. In about 1978, I gave a lecture to the group called the Students for a New Left on the university campus. And they were mostly, as they pointed out, from South America. See, because it kind of died a little bit in the United States, but in the other areas, it didn't die. And so these guys were like from Peru, Argentina, Costa Rica, places like that, and they were university students. And what I did for them, I documented that the New Left movement was actually being financed by the financial interests. See, and they were having a hard time with that because, you know, that's who they thought they were fighting against. We've seen a similar thing in recent years where the World Trade Organization, say, met, for example, Seattle, and you had the guys with the green faces and whatnot protesting against the World Trade Organization. Well, all they'd have to do is check and find out that their own organizational apparatus that got all their people in the street was being financed by the same guys that were running the World Trade Organization. See, it's this disconnect that happens there. How many of you here have seen the movie? I think it's called The Interpreter with Nicole Kidman in it. Okay. Now, that's a thinly veiled movie about Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe. Okay. And so Nicole Kidman is, you know, from that country. And part of the movie shows her in her revolutionary garb, you know, her camouflage stuff, carrying a machine gun. See, and the question that she's asking herself, how did something that was so good turn out to be so bad with the repressive dictatorship that Mugabe has imposed? Well, that's how communism always is. See, it has all this high-sounding words, the dictatorship of the proletariat. You know, they emphasize the proletariat, what they forget is the dictatorship. And it has all the high-sounding words. And I have with me a copy of the Communist Manifesto. The Communist Manifesto was published in, I believe, 1848. A little preface was written by Frederick Engels, and he also inserted the 10 points in here for overcoming advanced countries. Basically, this is the idealism. It appeals to a certain percentage of people who want to bring the system down and who want to impose a better order. The trouble is that, you know, Marxism is the economic theory that doesn't work, and Leninism is the terror to enforce it. It's how it always is. People naturally are not Marxist. They can't be. See, it doesn't work. So, the idealism is played upon. Now, the question is, see, who financed? See, who has always financed communism? Fidel Castro. You think he was a poor working class guy that worked in the cane fields of Cuba? Or do you think he was from a rich family as a university student educated in the United States and imbued with communist ideals in the U.S.? What do you think? See, that's how it always works. It is not the uprising of the poor and working class. It's a means by which the super rich abolish the middle class. It's what communism is. And since the middle class doesn't want to be abolished, they do it by force. The apathy then has been deliberately created. See, that's actually the goal. You know, let's run back 160 or 70 years, and let's put ourselves on the Oregon Trail in the early days of the Oregon Trail. where our wagon train is making its way across the plains of Nebraska, where we're keeping our eyes out for the Plains Indian. And let's say we just become apathetic. You know, we just don't care anymore. Okay? And so no longer do we put the wagons in a circle at night. We just kind of scatter out the camp. And we don't post a watch anymore. And we just don't care. And, you know, if we don't get going in the morning until about 10:30 or 11, you know, no big deal. We'll get there. What happens to an apathetic people? Yeah, you die. The Pawnee is coming with the rays of the rising sun. And you better be ready. See, that's how the Kiowa, or whatever. I mean, all those Plain Indians. You have to be ready. If you don't get the wagons moving, if you don't follow a good route, and you're with the Donner wagon train, trying to make her across the Sierra Nevada before the snow hits, they named a passer over him, but he didn't make it. See, when you lived closer to the ground, see, you couldn't be apathetic. Modern man is a couple steps removed from having to deal with the elements and having to deal with the day-to-day aspects of daily living, and the result is he becomes apathetic. So Satan wants people to be apathetic. See, the Bible says that he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who seek him. See, you've got to go after God a little bit. You've got to be asking the questions. You can't be apathetic. You have to be aggressive with regard to your own salvation, your own faith. And so Satan likes the blanket of apathy to fall on an entire society. And that's how he does it. Now, at a lower level, see, those who have designs on taking over a country like the United States of America, they want an apathetic public that doesn't care. So when the Supreme Court issued the decision in 1973, Roe versus Wade, where they arbitrarily said that unborn babies are not legal persons. See, the 14th Amendment of the Constitution was something that came into existence after the war between the states. And what it did was it took the Bill of Rights, including the right to life, liberty, and property, and they applied them at a state level. So the idea was that no state could exclude someone from being a real person. Okay. So up to that point, the Bill of Rights only applied at a national level. For example, many states actually had state churches for a number of years after the Constitution was ratified. And there was not a problem because the Constitution only operated at a national level, didn't apply to the states. Now, what the 14th Amendment did is it took the Bill of Rights and made it apply to all the states. And so when the Supreme Court said that unborn babies are not persons under the 14th Amendment, what they said is that unborn babies have no rights. They're non-existent. Now, that was done without precedent. Many of the modern court decisions, see, have come without precedent. See, it's the arbitrary law. Most recent example was the state of Texas had laws against sodomy. And about 2.5 years ago, U.S. Supreme Court overturned Texas anti-sodomy law on the basis of European court decisions. Now, see, this is huge. Now, how are they getting by with that? See, how is it that they're able to do that sort of thing? You have an apathetic public. See, a public that doesn't care. A public that would just rather, go to the football game, watch a movie, go to a play, play pool, play video games. See, rather just not think. Because thinking is too painful, and the consequences and the challenge of what will happen when you think. See? And so, the powers that be, and the powers that will be, they want an apathetic public. An apathetic public poses no hindrance to their long-term designs. Now, the issue of arbitrary law, then, is huge. An arbitrary law comes at us from three directions. First of all, it does come at us from the courts. See, the public has been convinced that the courts decide what the Constitution says. Now, that's dangerous. You know, I oftentimes use the illustration that if I have a contract with somebody to deliver strawberries, they got a contract to deliver strawberries. Let's say Gary's got a special deal with Costco, you know, and he needs so many pounds of ham every Monday morning, so many pounds of ham every Tuesday morning for the bagels, and he's got a contract with them, and then he shows up at Costco, they don't have the ham. At some point, he's going to pull the contract out and say, "Hey, you know, we got a deal here. You know, where's the ham?" And you know, I don't care where you have to get the pigs, but you know, the idea is, you know, well, look at the contract. I mean, it even said, "We the people," right? See, technically, the contract was between the federal government and the states, but they understood that it was the power was coming from the people. If the people see, if Gary lets Costco decide what the contract says, how do you think Costco is going to rule in terms of the contract? See, if the people let the Supreme Court say what the Constitution says, how do you think they're going to rule? See, it's an apathetic public that lets it happen. An apathetic, ignorant public. And the reason they are ignorant is because they are apathetic. Another source of law, arbitrary law, comes from the executive branch. The Federal Register every year is in excess of 70,000 pages per year, most of which is regulations. And, I mean, it's such a bureaucratic maze, you can't believe it. You know, you and I are probably violating all kinds of laws we never heard of. How does something become law? If it's published in the Federal Register and it's not acted upon by Congress, it automatically becomes law. It's arbitrary. Arbitrary. It's gotten so arbitrary that when you go to court, you're praying that you get the right judge. Because you have no idea. The executive branch law, of course, carries the same weight. The interesting thing is that the courts have ruled that anything executive branch lawmakers want to do, they can do. There's no restrictions on them. That's why the IRS, if they want to, if they decide you owe them, they just come and take it out of your bank account. You don't have due process, they'll just take it. You know, maybe you can get to tax court later. They just take it. See, how'd they get that power? How'd they get that power? At some point, see, the executive branch, when they want you, they'll just come get you. See, that's what happens when you allow that arbitrary power to be concentrated in the executive branch. Congress, frankly, is afraid of the executive branch. You know, you think a congressman wants to try to promote legislation abolishing the IRS? You think a guy's going to get audited? A number of years ago, I sponsored a speaker named James Jeffries. James Jeffries was a House of Representatives from the state of Kansas for a number of years. Had a very, very conservative voting record. And he tried to put some limitations on the IRS. As soon as he decided to not run for office, he spent 4 years and $400,000 fighting the IRS over stuff that there was no, I mean, they never got him on anything. But they went after him. He told me, he said, look it, when you have got a government that can single you out as an individual, he said, you have a criminal government. And the other source of arbitrary law is Congress itself. Do they pay any attention to the Constitution that puts restrictions on the federal government? None whatsoever. So what we have is we have this massive increase at all levels. And I can tell you, the bigger government gets, the less freedom you have. Now, we have considerably less freedom here in 2007 than we did in 1972 when we started this congregation. 1972, I just went down to the bank, got a checking account. Now you have to have employer identification number, you have to have driver's license, photos of everybody that's going to be on the signature card. You have to go through numerous hoops. You have to be really increasingly aware of the Section 501c3 regulations of talking about anything can do affecting legislation. There's so many aspects that are there that just never used to be. To say nothing of the paws of the federal government in the hands of every family. So, the challenge in front of us is great. What our job is to try to do is to try to sound the alarm with our neighbors, to try to shake our neighbors out of their apathy, to try to get people thinking out there. A lot of people won't move, but a lot of people will remember. And the day comes that it becomes obvious that they have to start thinking, you will be the one that they'll look up and talk to. So go ahead and open that mouth and don't let it be shut. If you seem a little bit like a nutcase, it's all right. The Apostle Paul was regarded as that. And, the time is to sound the alarm while you can still open your mouth in comparative freedom.